The following is a quarantine recording presented to you in Around Sound.
It was recorded with whatever was lying around.
Lady don't take no shit, insist on respect the sister, walk around like a womanish. She won't speak unless it's something worth saying, don't play. The girl take herself so seriously, people stare curiously. She got a natural way, her hips sway furiously, yet luxuriously. Carries herself like the cutest, most prettiest thing you see this side of the bay.
Hey! This is Lady Don't Take No, your weekly roundup of all of the real and none of the fake. I'm your host, Alicia Garza. This show is pro-Black, pro-queer, proudly feminist, and pro-do-what-you-like. Every week, you're going to get the best of what goes on in my head, what we loving on and what we hating on, what we might be and what we ain't going to do. Politics, pop culture, unseasoned portrayals of race massacres in this country that then go largely unaddressed and unaccounted for. We cover it all. We are recording from Oakland, California, the center of the known universe, where we are dealing with Rona and Reconstruction. It's a challenging time, a changing time. It's a time of transformation. It's all the things all the time nowadays, but we're going to help you understand the dynamics of this time every single week. So be sure to tune in, tell a friend, and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. We do it for the culture, so the pod is free 99, because we know that with a country in chaos, the least we could do is keep you from putting your money anywhere else than where it's needed.
She ain't no innocent little kitty chick. She's committing sins and ain't finishing. But because of her disposition, she ain't subject to criticism.
Our guest this week is an award-winning author and activist. He's a professor of media studies and urban education at Temple University. He's the founder and director of the People's Education Center in Philadelphia. Ebony Magazine has named him one of America's 100 most influential Black leaders. And if you want to check him out, he is currently the host of BET News and the Coffee and Books podcast. Or just stay where you are, because he is right here on this podcast. Please welcome Dr. Mark Lamont Hill. What's up, Mark?
What's up? So good to be
What's
here.
What's up? I'm so happy you're here. Thanks for joining us.
Anything for you.
Okay. Well, don't go too far with that now, because I'll be calling you asking for rent money. You saying anything now. I plan to cash in my chips, my friend. So I got to ask you, I mean, I don't know, maybe one day we'll change this intro, but I have been asking everybody about what their quarantine life has been like, because contrary to popular opinion, because people are still out here refusing to wrap it up and back it up, but we are still in a pandemic.
Thanks.
So I gotta know, what has your quarantine life been like, and have you developed any unique habits live and direct from Miss Rona?
So that's a good question. My quarantine life has been decent, and it's changed over the last, God, a year and a half. It's so crazy how we're almost a year and a half into this thing.
Mm-hmm.
At the beginning, it was honestly just sit at home and wait for it to end and hope that Donald Trump was going to be right about one thing, which was, you know, it'll be done by April. It'll be done by Easter. It'll be done by June, you know. And I was hoping. So it was a lot of food delivery and movies and waiting for something to happen. And then when I realized that my actual life was going to have a different routine and that I was going to have to make some different choices, I tried to incorporate exercise into it. You know, I turned my basement into like a little home gym so I could get some exercise and stuff like that.
There we go.
The internet became a whole different space for me. I was always on Twitter a lot and social media, but it became the source of entertainment. So suddenly, you know, the versus battles, you know what I mean? Like D-Nights, whatever it was, like it was like we're club quarantine. Like it was like, oh, this is home now.
Exactly.
You know, so that was it. And checking on my people a lot more. Having a lot more free time meant that I had to check on people in a different way and engage people in a different way. A lot more texts, a lot more phone calls, a lot more FaceTimes, stuff like that. Those are like the big changes.
Have you developed any new skills during the apocalypse?
Oh, yeah.
I think the apocalypse is here. And so I got to know what you bring into the table.
Oh, yeah. We mid-apocalypse right now. What did I develop? I started cutting my own hair, you know.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I'm probably going to cut it in the next hour. because I was like, you know, what happened was my barber, I got my last haircut not knowing it was my last haircut. And then my barber shut down his shop. And I was doing all this Zoom stuff and all these meetings. And for like the first 8 weeks, I didn't care. Yeah, but, you know, the way my hairline is set up, you know, is vulnerable at this age. So I had to be real careful with how I cut it, when I cut it, you know. But some shit had to happen. So I started first just cutting it down because I was like, look, it's Zoom. I could be like full Billy Ocean in the back. Nobody would know the difference. You know what I'm saying? Like, no one will know. So I'm just gonna lay it down. And then and I got good at it too. So then I started getting confident, you know? So I started trying to line it up and stuff. I had some setbacks, literally. But after about the second, third time, I got decent at it. It got to the point that when my barber reopened, I was still scared to go because, you know, he wasn't super into all the precautions, masks and yeah, all that
vaccines,
stuff.
Vaccines.
Exactly.
Know?
Exactly. You know, he went to like YouTube University, you yes, know, for the pen and was convinced.
Graduated in 5G logic.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. So I was like, all right, I ain't going to this damn barbershop yet. So I still, but I had enough confidence in my hand at that point that I was still able to make stuff happen, especially since I wasn't going out. All you need to see was the front. So
that's
if
right.
I messed it up too much, I just cut it back down and wait for it to grow back. But I did good. You know,
well done.
Yeah. So that was like the main stuff. I bought all the food. My freezer's still filled with all the shit I bought last year that I said I was going to make at home. All the recipe books. I got recipe books. I got raw materials. I got all this stuff. That's what I'm saying. And it's still sitting there. It's still sitting there.
I understand. You know, my sourdough starter never quite started.
See?
You know, I had to throw that thing out. I was like, I don't think I actually want this growing on my counter. But speaking of versus battles, before we dive in, I got to know, what are your thoughts? What should the next versus battle be?
There's only one that I want to see. Well, there's two that I want to see, but one isn't going to happen. One is an impossibility. That's Drake, Jay-Z.
Ooh. That might be too hot for this podcast, my friend.
There's so many levels and layers to why that would be interesting and problematic, but it would certainly explode the internet, right?
Yes, it would. Yes, it would, including my brain, actually.
Right. Mine too. But the one that I want to see that could happen, everybody wants Mary J. Blige on a versus. But the question is, who is her, you know, sort of peer that makes it? And the problem is because we think on gender lines, people be like, oh, Faith. She would, no. Something like Lauryn Hill, but it's like, because you also want genres to be similar. Otherwise, it's weird. So
that's
to
right.
My answer is Usher. Mary J. Blige versus Usher would be fire.
But I can't say this. I can't say it. It could be interesting.
Who wins that to you?
Usher.
Really?
Usher can sing.
Okay, so.
He can sing. I mean, Mary gets in your soul. You know what I'm saying? She gets in your soul. So it depends on what the criterias are. Because to me, I love me some Mary J. Mary J is like my angsty girlhood, you know, singing songs that were too damn old for me.
Right. You 12 years old, tell me you was a lover and a secretary.
Exactly. Working every day of the week.
I think something comes down to who you just like more. But I think they'd at least be evenly matched. Similar to Jill and Erica. While I thought give Erica a slight edge, like, they had enough hits that, like, you enjoy it. And I think Usher is the only person qualified from that generation to stand with Mary.
Mm-hmm. I could feel that. I've been convinced. I've been organized.
Wow. That's a major compliment. I feel proud of myself. This is better than my hairline.
I feel like, yeah, I think you're right. Or Mary could just do it on her own.
I'm good with that.
She could put albums against albums.
Yeah. Happy Mary versus Sad Mary. are we in the dancery? Or, are we, you know what I mean? Or is it my life? You know what I'm saying? I can do this. I'm with it.
This week, we have been commemorating the 100-year anniversary of the Tulsa Massacre.
Mm.
And child, there's all kinds of conversations about reparations. Or actually, if I'm being really honest, a lot of conversations about everything but reparations for the survivors of Tulsa and the other massacres that have occurred in this country as a result of white rage in response to Black power. So can you help us make it make sense? President Biden gave a whole long, at times off the rails speech this week, tasked Vice President Harris with like voting rights stuff, and also basically did that thing where he was like, we want the blacks to deal with the blacks. Does his comments, and let's put aside his comments about interracial marriage, but I guess we could put him in here because it's a part of the shtick. Do his comments measure anything close to reparations? Like anything close? Do you think the federal government is going to do anything for the survivors of these massacres?
No. The short answer is no. He gave that long meandering speech, but wouldn't even directly answer a reporter who asked about a presidential apology. The United States doesn't want to formally apologize for things because that presents a level of culpability, not just at the personal and human level, not just the ethical and moral level, but at the juridical level. Once you do that, it's like, oh, wait, apologize? Y'all admitting fault? Oh, now we owe something. And we saw that in Durban, you know, 20 years ago. You know, are you going to apologize for slavery? Are we going to acknowledge racism in America at a conference on racism at the structural level? You know, what are we willing to do? He's not going to do that. He's been consistent, despite the kind of progressive sort of green screen we've projected onto him recently. He's been very clear that he's against the Green New Deal, that he's against Medicare for All, that he's against defunding police, that he's against any kind of substantive move toward reparations. I mean, many of the progressive demands he said no to and hasn't even been coy. You know, this isn't like Obama fake left, go right or go middle. This is like, no, I'm just not. No.
Right.
Sit your ass down. I'm not Trump. Be happy. You know, and that's been his response to most of this stuff. And so when we look at the structural sort of inequality that was produced out of not just those massacres, but the broader kind of white supremacist empire that produces the possibility of those types of massacres, when we look at it, we know reparations is necessary. We know we have to repair the damage done, but there's no reason to believe that it's going to happen by presidential or governmental desire, right? Nation states don't have feelings, they have interests. Mm. And so we can organize the people so that our interests converge with theirs so that we win. I believe we can win this battle, but that's the point. It's a battle we have to fight for.
Mm. Wow. Nation states don't have feelings, they have interests. That's a t-shirt that actually needs to show up at Uncle Bobby's.
It's not a bad idea.
It was really good, Mark, I just have to say. So I'm watching the coverage, right? And they're talking about reparations. And, you know, the woman says, and I find this to be a common conversation, you know, the host says, in response to the idea that the federal government would cut these survivors a check, right? I mean, Biden has discretionary resources, essentially, that he doesn't have to get congressional approval for. And here we have these survivors of this massacre who can't even afford a plane ticket to go testify in front of Congress to talk about their experience. But Joe Biden doesn't do that in this speech. And this reporter, the host of the show, when confronted about, you know, well, why don't we cut the check, almost did this thing that I see happen a lot with white folks in reparations in these conversations, where it's like, well, what else? A check ain't going, it's, you're not going to get no damn check now, but what else would you like?
Right.
I mean, it just gets like slathered with mayonnaise, right? They'd be right. Like, oh yeah, yeah. That's so interesting. So you're definitely not cutting a check. You people are always asking for money. We're not going to give you any fucking thing, but what else would you like to talk about today?
Exactly.
And so I'm wondering if you can break down for folk, how are people to understand reparations besides cutting a check, right? Like, because I think this is like a real slippery slope for people where they're like, I just want my money, right? That's like a certain group of people. Just cut me a check and I'm good. And then there's like a, what actually repairs the harm of enslavement, brutality, murder, rigged rules, right? Like, can you talk with us a little bit about that so that the people can understand?
Yeah, I think you start us in the right place, which is to say that reparations is about repair. And so the first thing we have to do is assess the damage. So when we look at history and we look at the disenfranchisement that happened, when we look at the dispossession that happened, when we look at the physical violence, the emotional violence, the cultural violence, and the kind of track that has placed us on for centuries, now we can somewhat at least assess where we need to do the repair. The economic base that we're standing on is one that is shaky precisely because of the violence of slavery and centuries of structural inequality, institutionalized white supremacy. It plays out in the educational sector, plays out in the housing sector, plays out in the job sector. And so we need to plug those holes. Does a check fix it? No, but a check does help. So it's not either or, it's both and. We need a check. But in addition to the check, we also need a space to talk about what it would mean, for example, for college to be free for Black folk in the United States. Just as an example, right? That we no longer think about K-12 education is the only thing that's free, but now K-16 is free, if not higher. Now, I'd make the case that college should be free for everybody in this country. But so that creates its own tension that we can talk about. But at the very least, we need to think about how we can create resources and institutions that help close that gap. Now, part of the problem is you had folks like Bernie who were coming in saying, look, we need structural adjustment. We need to fix the damage done, but it's not a check. It's a kind of investment in the vulnerable that will certainly raise the boat of Black folk, but it also helps all poor people, right? I'm not against that. But as Dr. King said, if something special was done against the Negro, something must also be special done for the Negro, because there are things that can't be resolved at the level of class. They can't be resolved at the level of our socioeconomic status, you know, or the particular place we occupy in the labor force. And so, again, it's both and for me. I think some folk have made the check their hard line because they don't want to be swallowed up in some broad liberal agenda. And there are others who have been sort of stubborn about the check and said, no, a check is improper. That's often white liberals or so-called white progressives and radicals who say, no, the working class unite. You know what I mean? And ignoring the way that race plays out in unions, the way it plays out in organizing circles, the way it plays out in the economy, et cetera. And so I think we have to combine those two things. I think the one lesson that we learned from the pandemic, if nothing else, is that it's possible. You know, one thing I write about in my book, We Still Here, at the end, is that the state in so many ways tipped its hand at the end of this moment. You know, we can't decarcerate, really? Because, you know, when some COs in certain prisons were getting sick, oh, you know what? Those people are aging. They're not harmful. Send them out. That's what we've been saying for decades, right?
That's right.
Oh, when police don't want to get COVID, oh, you know what? That guy just has some weed in his pocket. Let him go. Throw it away, whatever. Now we can decriminalize, right? Now we're abolitionists, right?
Right.
And similarly, when American capitalism was vulnerable, oh, they found $1 trillion.
1.9,
right? And it was like, when reparations was like, where do we find the money? How do we get the money? What do we know to give it to? How do we determine it? How do we distribute it? All these questions that seemed like it was impossible.
Totally.
When America was about to fall, oh, they found them checks, they found them people, and they worked it out.
So did.
And so we know what's possible, more so than ever. You know, Dr. King said, only when it is darkest can we see the stars. At this moment last year where it was so dark, we saw the possibilities of a radical project. And that includes reparations. And so for me, now we see that we can do both.
Teach. I want to talk about the limits of progressive politics. And you just wrote an excellent book on this.
Well, thank you.
And so, you know, this is so timely because in the last month, well, first of all, I went and got your book. I got your book from Marcus Books because that's
nice.
How we do.
That's what I'm talking about. Support them Black bookstores. Shout out to Marcus.
Yeah, saying. And just a short time later, Mark, violence erupts again and escalates in Palestine. And I, for one, have not seen this level of mainstream conversation about Palestine in my entire life. Your comments on Palestine had CNN executives show you the door a few years ago. And now you have your own news network. We're going to come back to that in a minute. But you recently wrote a book about Palestine being left out of the progressive agenda. It's called Except for Palestine. And I'm hoping that you can break this down for our listeners. In the last few weeks, I've had so many friends and family members wanting to ask me, right, what I think about what they call the Palestine-Israel conflict. And I always have to start with, well, that's actually not the way to talk about it. And let's talk about why. So I'm hoping that you can break this down for our listeners. How are we to understand what's happening there? And why is it insufficient, right, to start off the conversation saying what's happening in Palestine or what's happening between Palestine and Israel is a conflict over religious values?
Yeah, that's a great question. The first thing is we should take the language of conflict away because conflict implies two competing positions.
Mm-hmm. Power on both sides.
With power on both sides, mm-hmm. exactly. That we're looking at, that we're just, that it's a dispute. Like it's a real estate dispute. It's mm-hmm. a religious dispute. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't say Native Americans in America, you know, and what do you call them? White settlers.
The pilgrims.
Pilgrims, right. The pilgrim Indian just conflict.
Right. No, we have Thanksgiving.
Exactly. You know, there's a way that conflict implies a level of parity that's simply unfair here or inaccurate here. People say it's complicated and it's, some things are complicated. There's a way that it's complicated and there's a way that it's really simple. Is that you have a population of Palestinian people who have lived in the region and who have been dispossessed by another group of people mm-hmm. Who came and settled. Is there a Jewish presence in Palestine? Yeah, there's always been a Jewish presence in Palestine. That's not in dispute. Do Jewish people have a right to be there in terms of in the land? Of course. That's also not in dispute. Do Jewish people around the world have a right to safety, dignity, self-determination? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Everybody does. Mm-hmm. So there's no conflict there. We all agree on that. The question is, do people have a right to displace and dispossess another group of people who are currently living in a place? Mm-hmm. And that becomes the question. And since the end of the 19th century, we have seen Zionist immigration to historic Palestine. When I say historic Palestine, I mean the country of Israel, what is now the state of Israel, and also what is the West Bank? What is Gaza? What is Golan Heights, et cetera? We've seen the settlement. And the problem with the Zionist project, it's a political project, first of all, right? It's not a religious project exclusively. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that there's not religious forms of Zionism. There's religious Zionism. There's cultural Zionism. But the Zionist political project was one of migration or immigration to historic Palestine to set up a Jewish state that would ultimately disenfranchise and ultimately push out, transfer, to use their language, the language of many of the philosophers and political theorists, transfer Palestinians out of their indigenous land. And that's the fundamental problem. In 1948, more than 750,000 Palestinians were pushed out of Israel. They're pushed out of what became the state of Israel in May of 1948. And as a result, they became refugees in their own home, in their own land, and in around the diaspora. Since that time, Palestinians have been fighting to return home. They have been fighting to get justice, and they've been fighting for a Palestinian state. I'll be really quick, but I just want to give the people just a little context, because this explains what happened 3 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. In 1967, there was another war, all right? The 1967 war, some call the Six-Day War, which meant that Israel accumulated even more of historic Palestine by defeating Syria and Jordan and Egypt in this war. Here's the tricky part. When Israel was formed in 1948, Israel's formed, and then Palestinians who lived in the West Bank, places like Bethlehem or Ramallah, that land was occupied. It was under occupation the same way that America occupied Iraq, mm-hmm. right? The land was under occupation. If a land is under occupation, you do not have a right. You cannot legally transfer people out. You cannot legally evict people. You can also not legally set up your own state there, right? After World War I, land acquisition by force is illegal, right? That's the whole point of nation states. That's the whole point of the UN Resolution 242. That's the whole point of all of this stuff is to say that you can't just have imperial power anymore. You can't just go on beating people in war and say, oh, my country now. You can't mm-hmm. debo people's countries. And so the West Bank and Gaza and all this stuff was under and Golan Heights and Sinai was under control by Arab countries from 1948 until 1967. Israel defeats those Arab countries, and now it controls these areas. But just because you control them doesn't mean that you can make it all Israel. Mm-hmm. The international community has been very clear in saying it's under occupation. East Jerusalem is disputed territory. It's under occupation as well. The West Bank is under occupation, etc. Israel has been somewhat recalcitrant in saying, no, this is all Israel's. This is Judea and Samaria. This isn't occupied. And so there's been a dispute that where Israel is in a relative minority and the rest of the world is saying, nah, this ain't y'all. You can't do this, right? So this has been the battle. So what we saw in East Jerusalem a few weeks ago was some Palestinians who were kicked out of Israel. They moved to this neighborhood in East Jerusalem called Sheikh Jarrah, and they've been living there since the 50s. And the Israeli government for decades has been fighting to evict them using laws that violate international law. Palestinians allege, the Palestinian families allege that the documents have been forged at different times. The Jordanian government confirmed that they had given those people the right to live there. But of course, again, they lost in 1967, so that became a battle. But again, just because you win a war doesn't mean you can kick people out. That's not how it works. And so when the evictions happened, you saw people protesting. So they're protesting in Aqsa Mosque during Ramadan, the holiest month in Islamic year. And what we saw was Israeli police attacking protesters. Mm. That caused an extraordinary response, not just from Palestinians in the West Bank and in Jerusalem, but Palestinians around the world and Muslims around the world. This is happening in the third holiest mosque in the world during the holiest month of the year. That's when the rocket fire started from Gaza as part of the protest. And that's when you saw the Israeli response to the rocket fire, which was already poised to go, and which was overwhelming and disproportionate and indiscriminate, all of which also violates international law. Caveat, the rockets do violate international, the Hamas rockets do violate international law. But firing a rocket at Israel from Gaza is not illegal as such because they're occupied people. Occupied people have a right to defend themselves. They don't have a right to hit civilian targets. So that's the tension there. What Israel did was also illegal and disproportionate, right? And so what we've seen over the last few weeks went from a battle over some houses in Sheikh Jarrah, which is part of a bigger conversation about ethnic cleansing, to an overwhelming, essentially, war on Gaza, which we haven't seen since the summer, since Ferguson summer, when there was a 51-day war going on in July and August. And so that's what's happening right now. It's a battle that is about the moment. It's a battle about proportionality and force. It's a battle about ethnic cleansing and displacement. But it's also part of, I think, a shifting narrative. Because as you pointed out, for the first time, the world is looking like, yo, they wilding. Yo, this is too much. This is too violent. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is crazy. Look, because they can see the images. They can feel it. They can experience it on the ground. And that's why the tone and tenor is changing. And that's why things that I said, and I ain't the first or the 15th or the millionth person to say it, but things that I said that got me in hot water are now becoming more and more part of the mainstream conversation. When B'Tselem or Human Rights Watch is saying, oh, wait, apartheid is happening here. Couldn't say that 5 years ago. Couldn't say that 10 years ago.
Anyway,
that's my... it's hard not to get into the weeds on this, but that I just want to get the context.
No, I appreciated it. And we need it because there's so much spinning of the story. And interestingly, this time around, I saw a resisting of the spinning of the story, but some of the same narratives are there. So I wanted to make sure for our listeners that folk could get context, right? But also the way you break it down is so excellent. So hopefully for folk who have been reaching out to me like, well, what do you really think about this? Now you know. I don't want to end this interview without talking about the Black News Channel, which recently launched. So can you tell us a little bit more about the vision for this project? What do you hope to achieve? And how can the people listening support the work you're doing?
Thank you. Black News Channel is a network that was launched a year and a half ago, and I became a part of it maybe 6 months ago now. And I'm very excited about it. The show is called Black News Tonight.
Yes.
It airs every day, Monday to Friday at 8 o'clock Eastern time. And actually, we re-air 8 o'clock Pacific time. We're in like 52 million households now. We're on Fios channel 612 starting in 2 weeks. We're on, if you're in Comcast, Xfinity, we're on a bunch of other channels, a Dish Network, all the big ones. We're also in a bunch of digital, Roku, Fire, Amazon Fire, all the stuff. You can find us. And the goal for the Black News Tonight for me is to create a space that just doesn't exist right now. Mm-hmm. A channel for daily news about what's going on in the Black world every day in the United States, but also around the diaspora. A platform for people to share their vision of the world, to debate, I see it as a radical space. You know, tonight, for example, it'll be old when people hear this, but you know, we have people fighting to release Sundiata Okoli. Mm-hmm. One of the people who was stopped on the New Jersey Turnpike with Asada Shakur and who's been in prison for since. We had the campaign to free Mumia on. We ran a story about the attempt to make these suicide watch bracelets in prison, you know, saying, wait a minute, you know, how does this enhance and fortify the prison itself when we want to be abolishing? So we're having those kinds of conversations. We're talking about Palestine. We're talking about fibroids for Black women. We're talking about rape culture. You know, we're also doing celebrity interviews. It's not all heavy. You know, we had a debate about who could beat Jodeci in a versus battle. You know,
and what was the conclusion?
Panama Jackson from some very smart brothers said nobody can. My position was three groups can.
Oh,
one for sure, which is New Edition. Right. Another one, which goes into the hits versus jams debate, is Boyz II Men. Boyz II Men has enough hits to beat them, but they don't have enough jams. So I will concede the Boyz II Men point.
Okay.
And then my radical position, I'm in the minority on this. High five.
Oh shit.
I don't need this right now.
I did not see High Five coming, but I'll allow it.
We couldn't see reparations coming. We couldn't see abolition coming. We couldn't see suffrage coming. I have a radical freedom dream that includes High Five getting the respect they finally deserve.
Okay, I will allow it.
So, but yeah, so we're having fun. It's great interviews, fun debates, but it's opportunity, honestly, to just create space for important conversations that I think is hard to find right now. Like, as much love as I have for a lot of shows that are out there, podcasts that are out there, web shows that are out there, it shouldn't be, when somebody's running for president, there has to be more than one stop. You know what I mean? Like, there just has to be. Like, Black people can't be monolithic.
That's right.
When Kamala Harris runs for president, and I'm sure she will at some point, again, I want her to stop at the Breakfast Club. I want her to stop on BET. I want her to stop, you know what I'm saying? I want to stop on Steve Harvey's radio show, mm-hmm. but she should also be a Black news channel.
That's right.
Right? And so that should be the conversation we're having. That should be the work that we do. And then lastly, there's some shit that Black people talk about that mainstream media just never is up on.
That's right.
Like, how are we going to talk about Naomi Osaka, right? Mm-hmm. How are we going to talk about what happened at the Versus Battle, mm-hmm. right? That there's things that we care about.
Yep.
That they don't. And news isn't just politics. And so we need to talk about every aspect of Black life, healthcare, housing, and hair, mm-hmm. all of it, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what we do.
I love that. And just like that, it's time for our weekly roundup of all the things Lady just ain't gonna do this week. Number one, say a lot of words that don't amount to much if we're really being honest. This week, we commemorated the 100-year anniversary of the Tulsa Massacre, and President Biden went to Tulsa to deliver a speech that was supposed to point toward what he would do to address and advance racial equity. I know, for some of y'all, white men saying lots of words mean something. And sure, words do mean things. Did I think it was important that President Biden made sure to say that what happened in Tulsa was a massacre and not a race riot, as it is usually described? Of course. Was it important that he acknowledged that things were stolen from the Black community of Tulsa? That the theft of businesses, lives, property, and dignity has generational impacts? Absolutely. But were the things he then proposed, and in some ways promised to do, worthy of the big words he used? No, absolutely not. Here's a quick summation of what he said he was finna do. Talk, study, and address broad problems rather than the specific problems facing the survivors and the descendants of the survivors of that massacre. And point towards what that can also look like for those of us who are also descendants and survivors of the massacres that occur and that continue to occur across the country in various forms. And let me say, the thing that creeps me out the most is that I just don't like how Joe Biden be with our folk. I just don't. It's pandering and more comfortable than I think he should be, especially given the little concrete commitments for Black people. But I'm gonna come back to that. Now, here's the reel on what he actually said and what it actually amounts to. He said he was going to do an aggressive effort to combat racial discrimination in housing, the details of which are basically unknown, except to say that we would ensure that we increase Black home ownership by addressing redlining, inequitable, racially motivated housing appraisals, and unscrupulous insurance companies. President Biden, homeownership requires good jobs and addressing racial inequities in the economy. He also talked about how small businesses are the engine of our economy. Okay, what are the things we're doing there? Government loans or subsidies for these businesses? Incentives for banks to lend capital to Black businesses? No, just the statement that it's important to have them. Okay, ciao. He also talked about increasing the share of federal dollars that goes to disadvantaged small businesses from 10% to 15%. Okay, but disadvantaged means a lot of things and a lot of people, including people of color, women, and more, which is no guarantee for Black communities. It's kind of like the All Lives Matter of moving federal dollars. Everyone and anyone who ain't a rich white guy, which is good, but doesn't have much to do with raising the economic prospects of Black communities like Tulsa. He talked about kids going to school. Great, President Biden, but how do we make sure those Black kids aren't tracked directly into jails? Starting kids earlier in school in communities that are severely underfunded means right now Black kids can go to jail earlier, especially when you won't do anything meaningful on policing or incarceration. He also talked about a broader National Business Administration that will move loans. Good. And how do you make sure that making it broader helps you deal with the specific problems of racial disparities in accessing those loans? Then we get into a bunch of other shit about infrastructure, but again, nothing specific about addressing racial disparities beyond access. Look, y'all, having more of things doesn't address why the rigged rules that keep people from getting to the pool of resources in the first place, it doesn't address why those exist or what he's going to do about it. So there you have it. For me, the president gets a D on this assignment, and we're grading him on a curve because he got the first part of the speech right. Strong premise, very faulty conclusion. So here's what Lady thinks about this. Don't be so happy to hear words that you don't care about what they actually mean. And damn it, they don't fucking mean much. And that's saying something from a man who has a job because of Black people. Did I forget to mention that he never, not never, said that the federal government will give money or acknowledgement to the living survivors of this massacre and the living survivors of the massacres that happened in dozens of other cities? Yeah, that part. Those folks, those survivors from Tulsa, went to Washington, D.C. to testify about what happened to them, and they didn't even have money to pay for the plane tickets to get there. Now, you make that make sense, and then revisit that conversation about reparations that Mark and I talked about in the interview. Okay, sorry to be a bummer, but it's true, words mean things. Here's what we want more of this week, though. I just gotta say it, belonging to the streets. So yes, people, I can personally attest to the fact that we are slowly reopening as a nation. People are out in these streets, honey, and it looks like that's gonna continue. And I'll tell you something, I love it. You really don't know what you got till it's gone. And have mercy, that whole hanging out thing has been gone for far, far too long. So do yourself a favor and get that vaccination, please. You really won't regret it, even if it means just that you can see your loved ones this summer. So over at the Black Futures Lab, we have an effort moving to make sure our communities get the vaccine and get all our questions answered and get our needs met around getting to the vaccine in the first place. So go on over there to www.blackfutureslab.org and let us know what's your why. And take the pledge to help make sure that we have each other's backs as a community when it comes to being resilient in the face of this crisis. Mark, tell the people how they can reach you if they're trying to follow you on the socials.
It's just my whole name, Mark Lamont Hill. I'm on everything but TikTok. I think I have a TikTok account, but my daughter ain't teach me how to use it yet. So I'm on everything else though, just Mark Lamont Hill. And also, if they want to support like bookstores, always support Marcus, always support Hakeem's, always support Mahogany. But they can support my bookstore, Uncle Bobby's.
Yes, please.
By going to UncleBobby's.com, Uncle B-O-B-B-I-E-S, and you know, support like bookstores and keep these institutions going.
That's right. They also have great swag, so. Walk.
Oh yes.
Don't run. Walk. Yep. I mean, don't rock. Don't walk. Run. Whatever. Get over there. Thank you so much, Mark. This was awesome. We appreciate you.
Appreciate you too.
That's it for Lady Don't Take No. But I'll be back here every single Friday morning to accompany you where there's a chance you might be commuting again. We appreciate you joining us, and let's keep the conversation going. Tell us what's on your mind, tell us what you like, and tell us what you ain't gonna take no more of. On Twitter, we're at LadyTake. On Insta, we're at LadyDon'tTakeNoPod. We're also on Facebook at LadyDon'tTakeNoPodcast by Alicia Garza. We post ways to do something about things you hear on this show all over our social media. So if we got you amped up today, check out the socials to find out how you can take action. And let's give a special shout out to Jahari Farrar for making sure the people get what they need from our socials. We appreciate you. Please subscribe and write us a review and let the people know what you've heard here today. Our producer is Phil Circus. Our incredible theme is by Latyrix. This pod is supported by the Black Futures Lab. And me, I'm your host, Alicia Garza. Remember, words mean things, and we deserve more than to just be happy that words are being said, but ain't no meaning attached to those words. Also, that hot girl summer is right around the corner, so get your vaccines so you too can belong to the streets. And join the Black Futures Lab in making sure that our communities get the information and access we need by going to www.blackfutureslab.org. That's right, I said it. Because Lady Don't Take No.
Lady don't take no, she insists on respect the sister, walk around like a woman is. She won't speak unless it's something worth saying, don't play. The girl take herself so seriously. People stare curiously. She got a natural way, her hips sway furiously. Yeah, luxuriously. Carries herself like
love y'all.